Random House Audiobooks presents Desolation Island by Patrick O'Brien.
Desolation Island. The breakfast parlour was the most cheerful room in Ashgrove Cottage, and although the builders had ruined the garden with heaps of sand and unslaked lime and bricks, and although the damp of the walls of the new wing in which this parlour stood still smelt of plaster, the sun poured in, blazing on the covered silver dishes and lighting the face of Sophie Aubrey as she sat there waiting for her husband. A singularly lovely face, with the lines that an earlier poverty had marked upon it quite smoothed away, but it had a somewhat anxious look. She was a sailor's wife, and although the Admiralty had allowed her the company of her husband for a surprising length of time, appointing him, much against his will, to the command of the local sea fencibles in recognition of his services in the Indian Ocean, she knew that this period was coming to an end. The anxiety changed to unmixed pleasure as she heard his step. The door opened, a ray of sun fell on Captain Aubrey's beaming face, a ruddy face with bright blue eyes, and she knew as certainly as though it had been written on his forehead that he had bought the horse he coveted. "There you are, sweetheart," he cried, kissing her and lowering himself into a chair by her side. "Captain Aubrey," she said, "I'm afraid your bacon will be cold." "A cup of coffee first," said he, "and then all the bacon in the world. Lord, Sophie," lifting the covers with his free hand, "here's Fiddler's Green. Eggs, bacon, chips, kippered herrings, kidneys, soft tack. Ha! How is the tooth?" Here he was referring to his son George, whose howls had made the household uneasy for some time past. "It is through. He cut it in the night, and now he is as good as gold, poor lamb." Jack laughed with pleasure, but after a pause, and in a slightly conscious tone, he said, "I stepped into Carol's yard and bought the filly. Quite apart from the foal she will bring, it will be a remarkable saving, since she will train with Oat Boy and Whiskers, with her to bring out their mettle. I will lay 50-1 on placing Oat Boy in the Worrell Stakes." "I long to see her," said Sophie, with a sinking heart. She disliked most horses, except those of the very gentle kind, and she particularly disliked these running horses. "How is your mamma this morning?" "She seems quite well, I thank you, Jack. She'll come down with the children. She's quite excited about seeing the doctors."
"But what can be keeping Bondon?"
said Jack, glancing at the stern regulator, his astronomical clock. "Perhaps he fell off again."
"Killick was there to prop him up. No, no, 'tis 10-1 they're prating about their horsemanship in the Brown Bear Tap, the infernal lubbers."
Bondon was Captain Aubrey's coxswain, Killick his steward, and whenever it could be managed, they moved with him from one command to the next. And while both were prime man-of-war's men, neither was a great hand with a horse. Yet it was clear to all that the mail addressed to the commanding officer of the Sea Fencibles had to be fetched by a mounted man, and daily the two traversed the downs on a powerful, thick-set cob. A powerful, thick-set woman, Mrs. Williams, Captain Aubrey's mother-in-law, walked in, followed by a nurse with the baby, and a one-legged seaman shepherding the two little girls. Most of the servants in Ashgrove Cottage were sailors, partly because of the extreme difficulty of inducing maids to stay within reach of Mrs. Williams' tongue. Upon seamen, however, long inured to the admonition of the boatswain and his mates, its lash fell unregarded, and in any case its virulence was much diminished, since they kept the place as trim as a royal yacht.
"Good morning to you, ma'am," said Jack, rising. "I trust I see you well." "Good morning, Commodore, that is to say, Captain. You know I never complain, but I have a list here," waving a paper with her symptoms written upon it, "that will make them stare. We're not to be talking about me, however. Here is your son, Commodore, that is to say, Captain. He has cut his first tooth."
She led the nurse forward by the elbow, and Jack gazed into the little pink, jolly, surprisingly human face among all the wool. George chuckled and displayed his tooth. Amos Dray, formerly bosun's mate in HMS Surprise, shaded his mouth with his hand and in a deep rumble whispered,
"To the line, my dears."
The two little pudding-faced twin girls in clean pinafores stepped forward to a particular mark on the carpet, and together, piping high and shrill, they cried, "Good morning, sir."
"Good morning, Charlotte. Good morning, Fanny," said their father, bending down until his breeches creaked to kiss them.
Almost at the same moment, Bondon brought in the post. He
begged pardon for being late. The fact of the matter was, it was market day down there. "Crowded, I dare say."
"Uncommon, sir. But the fact of the matter is, Killick made a purchase. A legal purchase."
"Aye? A nag, I suppose. Well, I wish him joy of it. He may put it in the old byre."
"Not exactly a nag, sir, though it was in a halter."
"A wife, sir."
"What in God's name does he want with a wife?"
"Why, sir," said Bondon, blushing and looking quickly away from Sophie, "I can't rightly say, but he bought one, legal. It seems her husband and she did not agree, so he brought her to market in a halter. And Killick, he bought her, legal."
"But you cannot possibly sell your wife. Treat women like cattle," cried Sophie. "Oh, fie, Jack, it's perfectly barbarous."
"Does seem a little strange, but it is the custom, you know, a very old custom."
"Surely you will never countenance such a wicked thing, Captain Aubrey?"
"Why, as to that, I should not like to go against custom. Where would the navy be without we followed our customs, eh? Let him come in."
"Well, Killick," he said, when the pair stood before him, his steward, an ugly, slab-sided, middle-aged man, the young woman, a snapping, black-eyed piece, a perfect sailor's delight.
"Well, Killick, now I come to think of it, you had a wife in Marne. She washed my shirts. You must not commit bigamy, you know. It's against the law." "Which I had too, Your Honour, t'other in Wapping Dock. But they was more in the roving, uncertificated line, if you follow me, sir. Not bought legal, the altar put into my hand."
"Well, so I suppose you want to add her to the establishment. Now you'll have to go in front of the parson first, however. Cut along to the rectory."
"Aye, aye, sir. Rectory it is."
"Lord, Sophie," said Jack when they were alone once more, "what a coil." He opened the mailbag. "One from the Admiralty, another from the Sick and Hurt Board for me, and two for Stephen, care of you." "I wish I could take care of him, poor dear," said Sophie, looking at them. "These are from Diana, too." She laid them on a side table, to wait with another, addressed in the same bold, determined hand, to Stephen Maturin, Esquire, M.D. Diana Villiers was Sophie's cousin, a slightly younger woman, with a far more dashing style and a black-haired, dark, blue-eyed beauty. At a time when Sophie and Jack had been separated, long before their marriage, both Jack and Stephen Maturin had done all they could to win Diana's favours, and Jack very nearly wrecked both his career and his marriage, while Stephen, who had supposed she would marry him at last, had been most cruelly wounded by her departure for America under the protection of a Mr. Johnson. He had supposed she would marry him, for though his reason told him that a woman of her connections, beauty and ambition could not be an equal match for the illegitimate son of an Irishman and a Catalan lady, a short, disagreeably plain man, whose ostensible status was that of a naval surgeon, his heart was entirely lost to her, and to his infinite cost it had overruled his head. Even before we heard she was in England, I knew that something was working on his mind, poor dear Stephen, said Sophie. Jack, why do you not find him a decent servant? At the worst of times, Killick would never have allowed you to go out in a shirt a fortnight old. Why has he never had a steady, reliable man? Jack knew very well why Stephen had never kept a servant for any length of time. Never a man.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?